This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
And Gregory said, "The major problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature works and the way people think."
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I am joined by Nora Bateson, filmmaker and daughter of the famous social scientist Gregory Bateson. Nora's new movie is An Ecology of Mind, an intellectual biography of Gregory. Nora, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Gregory Bateson was an innovator and founder in many fields. I learned of his ecological theories in the 1970s, partly due to Stuart Brand, publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog. Bateson quotes inspired me, but I have to tell you, they also mystified me at the same time. For those who don't know, can you give us a quick snapshot of our subject? Where did Gregory Bateson come from, and what was his official scientific training?
I'm glad to hear you say that you were mystified, because I think if you're mystified, that's a good sign. Gregory's training came originally from his own household. His father, William Bateson, was a scientist and a geneticist, in fact, and one of Britain's foremost biologists of his time. In fact, he coined the term genetics. So William Bateson, Gregory's father, really instilled in his kids a pursuit for the interaction between things. I mean, of course, that at its core is how genetics has been studied. So that he integrated, William Bateson, the works of William Blake and his love for art with his love for nature and his fascination with pattern. And that would go on to be very important to Gregory's work. He studied at Cambridge and got a degree in zoology. And at that point, he went to Galapagos, I think, in 1924, and decided that he didn't really want to take samples, and he wasn't sure how to fit the way that zoology was functioning at that time in with the pursuit of his own interests. So he became an anthropologist and was on his way to New Guinea fairly soon after that and met with Margaret Mead. At that time, there wasn't any particular degree you could get in anthropology. It was a brand new field. 1936, I think they went over and met in New Guinea. They together started to formulate what became a kind of a lens that brought together William Bateson's approach of looking for pattern and his love of the arts with Margaret's study in behavior. And they brought it together to form what would be a lens that Gregory then used throughout his work in several different disciplines, ranging from psychology to semiotics to anthropology. He was at the sort of beginning of the cybernetics, I don't want to say movement, the beginning of the formation of what became cybernetics. And he focused with that lens on all manner of life in all its different forms, from a biological level to a psychological level to anthropological, culture, math, in all these different directions, and was looking for how things are related, interrelated, interdependent.
He's a tricky man to define, partly because he didn't like definitions. He, as soon as you gave him a definition, he sprung a little outward for it and wanted to see all the connections around it. And that's something I want to talk to you about. I want to skip over cybernetics, unfortunately, because we could do a whole program on that. I'd like to move towards psychology, though, and particularly his involvement with a group of others in developing the double bind theory. What is that theory?
The double bind theory has been taken to mean different things to different groups. So I think it's a good idea to start from the beginning here, which is to say that for Gregory, the double bind theory was really a pattern. It was what he saw as a very useful tool in noticing a pattern in which evolution is an imperative. What the double bind is, just to briefly describe it, it's a lot like what we know as a catch-22, only the stakes are higher and the effect on the person is what is of interest, not the catch-22. Okay, so for example, he used to use, and this is the example he uses in the film, the bread and butterfly from Through the Looking Glass.
The story Gregory used sometimes to explain the double bind was about the gnat in Through the Looking Glass.
And the gnat is a still small voice explaining the insects of Through the Looking Glass land to Alice. We don't have butterflies, we have bread and butterflies. And the bread and butterfly has wings of very thin slices of bread and butter and a head made of a lump of sugar. Alice says, what does it live on? The gnat says, weak tea with cream in it. Alice saw a difficulty.
So she said, what happens if it can't find any? The gnat says, it dies. Alice says, that must happen rather often. The gnat says, it always happens. The double bind in which the bread and butterfly finds himself, namely that if he gets his food, his head dissolves in it. Therefore, his only hope of survival is not to find any food, but then he starves. And this is, you see, a formal double bind of the simplest kind.
So on that level, I think Gregory saw the double bind as a pattern, and one that could be applied to many different kinds of circumstances, not just psychology, but also evolution, creativity, learning, etc., cognition. However, the double bind came to be part of a description of a possible cause for schizophrenia. Probably it's better used in other circumstances. What Gregory obviously felt about that, if you study Gregory's work at all, you'll know that his relationship with causality is never linear. So to have it be said that he thought that the double bind caused schizophrenia isn't in keeping with his thinking at all. It is potentially part of a cause. They certainly don't help. And originally, the discussion of the double bind in family relationships would look something more like this, where you have a child who wants to please his mother. So if he shows affection to his mother, however, he gets met with, don't be a sissy, don't be a mama's boy. And if he doesn't show affection to his mother, he's met with, what, don't you love me? And so that child is in a more of a relationship form of a double bind, where the bread and butterfly is in a more
existential, really.
Existential form of a double bind, right. So there's lots of different forms of them, and in any of their forms, they are a call to shift the thinking. There's a need to take the thinking to another level. Upward, downward, deeper, wider, however you want to look at it, the context has to shift for the being in the double bind to find their way out of it.
Well, I'm interested to hear you say that because, you know, surely we're in a double bind right now as a civilization. We need fossil fuels to feed the billions of people we've got on the planet. There's no other way we can feed them. And yet if we continue to use them, we may shift the climate to a point where billions of people may die because agriculture doesn't work anymore, for example, and many other bad things happen. So it seems like we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. But you're suggesting that there could be a way out of the double bind.
Absolutely. I think your assessment is spot on. In order to live from one day to the next, we need to get in our cars and we need to take part in a system that is, in the long term, that may or may not be all that long, inherently deadly. It's inherently eliminating the possibilities of future generations. If we get out of it, we can't feed our kids. And if we stay in it, we're eliminating the possibility for our children's lives. Either way, we're hooped. What do we do? And I think that it's really useful to look at the double bind as a pattern because it does offer, first of all, the familiarity, just to be able to say, oh, this is a pattern. This happens from time to time, and not feel quite so engaged in the feedback loop that we're in. I mean, the first step is to see it as a feedback loop. Then, by virtue of doing that, we're able to contextualize it within something larger. I have to say that from here, the next movie that I make, I want to make about improvisation, because that is what I see as being the way we get out of double binds.
I have one word for you then, and it's not one I'm going to explain on the show, but it's bricolage, and that may be part of your film, who knows. This is Radio EcoShock with filmmaker Nora Bateson. It's called An Ecology of Mind, about her famous father, Gregory Bateson, and to a certain degree about Nora's relationship with him. Nora, I think Stuart Brand was attracted to your father's work in part because of what it said to a generation looking for answers beyond the button-down collars of the 60s, particularly a whole earth solution. Can you talk about Gregory Bateson and the new young crowd in the 1970s?
What a wonderful scene that was. It was a time and an era when there was a great opening and when it was time to break the rules. There was a culture of people who were the change makers. They had amazing conversations, which we're only just now beginning to be able to sort of harvest from. Stuart Brand was certainly part of that group. There were lots of people, Michael Murphy. And before them, in fact, there were the group of the people who were part of the Macy conferences. That era offered such an incredible opportunity because there was a culture of people who were, like you said, breaking the rules. And as they did that, they had each other to bounce ideas off of. Incredible things happened. Also, a lot of nonsense. I grew up in various communities, from the Lindisfarne Foundation to the Zen Center in San Francisco to Esalen Institute. In each of these communities, there were people whose real commitment was to finding a way of living that, from communication to food to intellectual pursuit to philosophy to science, they were looking for a way to integrate the human experience with the natural world, and felt that if there was a more holistic approach, that there would be greater satisfaction and greater happiness. And to do that, they took away all the things that would affirm our cultural identity. So, for example, Esalen was out on the rugged coasts of Big Sur. There wasn't a shop around. There was hardly telephone service. People who were there were trying out new ways of living to see if they would work. You know what? They were improvising. They were trying out new things, some of which worked out great, some of which didn't. But that's life, right?
Yeah, and one of the things that kept coming up in this film for me over and over, and perhaps it's the central theme of the film, was Gregory Bateson's insistence that all things are connected, that we have a connection with nature, and that really it's an illusion to think that we could be anything other than part of nature. Can you talk to us about that?
The word interconnection has become a sort of a signature word in the ecological movement. I have to just take a moment to say, I think it's important to actually look deeper than that. When we, by virtue of our own language, when we talk about interconnection, we're still talking about, somewhere in your imagination, I bet you can see, a series of dots connected by lines. And if you were to illustrate the universe as an interconnected thing, you might have various entities and lines that connected them. And where Gregory's work differs there, it's subtle. So bear with me, is that interconnection is actually interrelatedness. It's actually interdependency, so that those lines, if you could envision them not as static, linear, connected things, but as electric, that they're wiggling and they're dynamic and they're pulsing and they have rhythm and they're evolving. The space in between is evolving. So that's where his idea of what connects us is in itself a learning process. It becomes part of his lens that he had to offer us, which would direct us not so much to making change at the level of policy or economics or commerce, religion, but at a different level. We are participants in a larger system. And as participants, we are in a dynamic system with the creatures and the plants and all the living things, the systems, the wind, the oceans, the systems of our planet. And to recognize the pattern that connects is to recognize that we are in a kind of empathetic relationship, that there are things, there are similarities that we can see when we look at the plankton or we enjoy the wind in our face. There are relationship similarities that we can recognize. Those are at another level than the kind of human constructs such as economics and politics. So the change that Gregory would discuss, or the opening of the possibility of shifting our perspective.
The question of what the ideas are that govern how we think about the world, that those ideas again become linked up with how we live in the world, what sort of damage we do to it, what sort of pollution, exploitation, etc., etc., we engage in.
One thing I noticed in this film is that, Hollywood directors would have told you, you must include the love life, the struggles with problems, the dark sides of the man, etc. And yet you went for a pure intellectual biography, kind of the story of his lasting gifts, I would say. Is that going to sell? How are you going to distribute this film, and how can people find out more about it?
I hope it sells. I chose to do that because, honestly, his love life wasn't nearly as interesting as his ideas. I would like to distribute it in any way that its sales can catch the wind. I'm amazed because originally I made this film thinking, oh, it'll probably be a classroom tool. And I've been surprised because there's actually an audience that is interested in it, people who don't know his ideas, who aren't in the midst of studying them. And I think it's actually a good intro to some basic systems theory concepts and a really interesting perspective on the world. I'm going from Vancouver this weekend. I'm going to be down in San Francisco doing a preview for the Bioneers, which is a group of just incredible and wonderful ecologists. And from there, the film is going to Italy. And I have some premieres in Rome and in Milan and in a town outside Venice called Schio. Later on in the beginning, actually, of 2011, I'm going to do a opening at the Museum of Natural History in New York City and just take it from there. See what happens. I've submitted it to film festivals, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of traction it has and whether people like it.
Is there a website for the film?
There is a website for the film. It's www.anecologyofmind.com. And I also have a Facebook site for it, which is An Ecology of Mind, the Gregory Bateson documentary, where you can see a trailer and screenings are posted and there's some photos from the film. But this is the beginnings. And the other thing is that not only did I not wash out the dirty laundry on screen of our family history, but I also took the liberty to use long shots and to allow these people, there's some interesting people in the movie who have a lot to offer, and these ideas need time to understand and to articulate. And so I broke the rules and made space for that time.
Well, what I did was I played it again a couple of times because it's deep. I think it's a deep film and definitely worth watching. We've been talking with Nora Bateson, daughter of a social scientist and anthropologist, too many fields to list them all, really. He lived from 1904 to 1980. Her film explaining Bateson's lasting intellectual gifts is called An Ecology of Mind. It plays at the Vancouver International Film Festival on October 2nd and 3rd. And as we have heard, it's going on to other film festivals. Nora, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. I hope this was useful.
Definitely. I'm Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.